So this morning, I thought maybe on Easter, we could talk about redemption. And as we celebrate resurrection, what that means. So why don't we do, just to get us started, turn to a neighbor and just share with them. When I say redemption, what comes to mind? All right, go ahead. All right, redemption. Let's hear some of these. What comes to mind? Anybody? Second chances. Okay, good. Uh-huh.
A friend of my daughter said to me one night, everything can be redeemed.
Okay.
And I'm still chewing.
Okay. So your daughter said to you one night,
a friend,
okay, said that everything can be redeemed. So you're still thinking about that. Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Well, I was thinking through this. And I have two dogs. I have a picture of them. The brown one, her name is Trixie. I've had 7 dogs in my lifetime, and she by far is my favorite dog. The white one I love in the same way, but less. Same kind of love, just less of it. So when we first got Trixie, we accidentally adopted her. Her first adoptive family, we don't know her history before that. The owner, she got a new job. She couldn't take care of her anymore, so she called us, and we said, we'll take her. So our first day with Trixie was memorable. We left home. We had never left her at home. And we came back to the cliched adopted dog tornado in our living room. So she went through every shoe. She was 100%. Chewed through every shoe, tore up our garbage, had ravaged through whatever food was accessible. And then the peak of it, like her finest work of art that day, was she ate half our door. So she has an underbite. If you go to the next slide, is there a picture of an underbite? Yeah, you can kind of tell. But she was trying to rip the door open to get out. And so she was slowly getting her jaw. This is a portrait of her. She got her jaw underneath and just started ripping up pieces of the door, and she ate them all. There were no pieces left. She literally ate half her door. Okay. So four years later, she is the best behaved, gentlest, kindest, sweetest dog. She's really useful. She cleans the white dog's eyes and ears. She just just licks it up, which is kind of gross, but very useful. And every day when I come home, I'm coming home, pull up in my drive with my bike, she can hear me coming. And she always runs and grabs her rubber hamburger she's got in her mouth. And then her tail is like wagging so hard, her whole butt's moving. And then I open the front gate and she sings. She goes, like every day. And so between 4 years, it's like two different dogs. It really is. So the question is, did we change her? And what I want to propose this morning is that we didn't change her. That through love and affection, we returned her to herself. We returned her to who she was always supposed to be. And so for this morning, for our purposes, I'd like to maybe define redemption as being returned to ourselves. Thomas Merton says this, "We discover our true selves in love." And so the task is that when we read the Genesis narrative, when we read where God creates, so the Genesis narrative is always meant to be who and why, not necessarily how. It's supposed to be about God and his love for us. And he creates now the oceans. Imagine standing like in front of the Pacific Ocean for the first time. And he goes, it's good. Wow, this is really, really good. He creates the stars and the moon, and it's really, really good. He creates land animals. Imagine the first baby bunny. And God sees this, and he's like, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Imagine the first taste of a mango, and it's really, really good. And then in the narrative, it says that he created man and woman in his image, and it was really, really good. And I don't know if I have that same sense of that goodness, that guttural, like, oh, that's really good, when I think of that moment when God created me. I don't know if I do. I don't know that on that wintry morning in February 1974 in rural Canada, when these two Cantonese parents, and then out comes this pale, follically challenged, weak-eyed little Cantonese Canadian boy. I don't know if in that moment I have this sense where God's like, that's really, really good. And then this morning for us to consider then, what if resurrection and redemption is the returning to ourselves, returning us to each other, returning the earth to herself, and then we got to participate in it. And so this morning, we're going to be in an unusual text. It's the lectionary text in Jeremiah. It's the Old Testament text. But I think it beautifully unpacks redemption for us and to ask, what does this mean? How does this change the way we live? So we'll be in Jeremiah chapter 31. We'll have verses 1 through 6 on the screen. Just turn to a neighbor and read it, and then we'll walk through it. All right, Jeremiah 31, go. All right, so Jeremiah's writing. He's writing in a time where his communities have been ravaged by war. There's infighting, and he's known as the weeping prophet. So if he were, you know, around in the late 90s, he would have had bangs covering his eyes, and he would have been a singer-songwriter, and the ladies would have loved it. But they call him the weeping prophet because things aren't going well. So in chapter 31... in these few verses, he gives us some metaphors that God's returning us to that I think are unbelievably beautiful. And he says this, "At that time, declares the Lord, I will be the God of all the families of Israel, and they will be my people." So the metaphor he's using is family, that somehow they've been disconnected, and he's bringing them back together as family. This is what the Lord says. The people who survived the sword, so they're in the midst of war, will find favor in the wilderness, and I've come to give them rest. So the first metaphor that we're being returned to is this metaphor of family. I think there's a couple warranted questions to ask. Why Israel? How does that relate to us now? It's kind of strange. And then two, what's the state of the family while he's writing? So why Israel? So the quick way to explain it is this. So in the scriptures, God always chooses someone or a group of people. It's usually not because they're impressive or that. It's usually the opposite. And whoever God chooses, their job is to disperse blessing. Does that make sense? So I'm giving you blessing, and then you've got to pass it on. So maybe a way to understand it is like this. I was at the H-E-B Mueller on Wednesday, and we have a friend visiting from Seattle. A bunch of families and kids were there. My family had already eaten dinner. So we went and I bought some ice cream sandwiches. I bought like a box. There's a dozen of them. Okay. So what I usually do is I just walk up to one of my boys and I'll just give him the box. Okay. I don't even have to say anything. I don't even have to like sign, like I just give them the box and they know instinctively, oh, dad's not asking me to eat 12 ice cream sandwiches. I get one. And then my job is to disperse the blessing. Does that make sense? So in the scriptures, God chooses Israel as the disperser of blessing, not because they're impressive. He doesn't choose Rome. He doesn't choose Babylon. He chooses Israel and says, now I'm going to bless you and disperse it. So he goes to Abraham. Look at the stars. Look at the sand. That's how many people that you're going to disperse this blessing to. So by the time you get to this text, at some point, someone gets the blessing and then keeps it. Like it stops. At that point, arguments form. Arguments turn into conflict. Conflict turns into war. By the time we're writing, civil wars happen. They're divided into North and South. To make matters worse, other countries have come in and occupy them. So they're displaced and their family is fractured. And I think this image and this picture, if we were to choose one metaphor that describes the world, I think fractured family is a pretty good one, right? You look at the geopolitical landscape, it's fractured. You look at the Ukraine and Russia and Crimea, they're fractured. You see Sunni and Shia, Hutu and Tutsi. You see the U.S. and Canada, fractured. Back off my border, eh? But even in our country, right? You see the dialogue of Republican and Democrat. You know what it sounds like to me? It sounds like my kids, when we're on a road trip, my boys bickering in the backseat. That's what it sounds like. And when my boys do that, I just turn around and go, oh, this is fantastic, right? This is so productive. We should keep doing this. And I just want to shake the politician. This is great, right? This is good for our country and our world. And it's fractured. And I could give the mic to every person in this room, and we could come up here and tell personal stories of fracture, of friendships, of neighbors, of family, of coworkers. And what Mother Teresa says, you want to define what's wrong with this world? She says this: we've forgotten that we belong to each other. And that maybe in this Easter, what redemption means, and as we celebrate resurrection, is to be reminded that we're family. We belong to each other. It's not black, white, rich, poor, Republican, Democrat. We're all God's family. Katie Payne, she's a biosonic, I think that's her title, a researcher. She was the first researcher who discovered that whales sing, I think 25 years ago. She's lived on the coast of Argentina. And her latest work, she works with elephants and communities of elephants. And she says these elephants are so uniquely individual, each of them. And then they have this sense of togetherness that's usually run by the matriarch of that tribe. So sometimes it's divided by blood, but usually it expands more than that. And she says she remembers one time there was a baby elephant like across the field. They were watching on this watchtower. And then there was like the whole community of elephants, about 80 of them. The grandmother was on the further side, and the baby just made this tiny little cry, and the grandmother came charging through the pack and rescued her. And so they were studying this young elephant, and physically, she wasn't strong enough, and so she didn't make it, and she passed. In their research, they spent 2 days videotaping what happened, and then they documented how the community responded to this tragedy. And for 2 days, over 100 elephants came by, both blood and not blood, and every elephant stopped with an act of compassion. Some of them would circle. Others would just kind of bow. Over 25% of the elephants stopped and lifted her up and then just put her down. There was one particular adolescent elephant who came by, wasn't related to her, came by and picked her up 57 times, left 5 times, came back again. And she says the elephants have this sense of kinship and a family. And then she says human beings, the human species, could learn a lot from elephants. And so maybe for us, the question is, who is that other that it's easy to put in a box? But to remember that this is family, it's kinship. It's not just this other category. You know, Jesus tells this story one time. There's a guy who's pretty wealthy. He dresses in a fashion. He likes wearing nice clothes. He eats good food. He's a foodie. So he probably lives in Austin somewhere, right? So he's on Yelp and giving reviews and talking about new food trucks. And then a homeless person gets dropped on his doorstep who's got sores all over. And then he just lays there. And then in Jesus' story, just dogs lick his wounds while occasionally the rich guy will show pity and then just throw him some scraps. And then in Jesus' story, they both die. And then one is with God and the other is not with God. And then the rich guy who's not with God, he doesn't, in the story, I found this fascinating. He doesn't pray to God. He prays to Father Abraham. And in this story, I think Jesus' point is more than greed, more than disparity of wealth, is that this guy forgot the guy on his doorstep was family. And he goes to Father Abraham. And Father Abraham basically says, that gap, that chasm you created with your own family, you created that. And that chasm you'll have for eternity. And so for us, maybe in this Easter, who is that person that we need to re-belong to? And my prayer, so think of that person. There's actual people in our lives. And my prayer is that as we're reconnecting with that person, that will probably help that person discover themselves. We probably will. And then I think at the same time, as they're discovering themselves, they'll help us discover who God created us to be as a family. And so that's the first metaphor. And he says, at that time, I'll be the God of all families of Israel, and they will be my people. Let's keep going. And then he says in verse 3, the Lord appeared to us in the past, saying, I have loved you with an everlasting love. I have drawn you with unfailing kindness. He's saying, I've always loved you. Like, I know you guys are infighting. You've made some choices. There's civil war going on. You're being occupied. But I have never stopped loving you. You're experiencing some of the consequences of choices you've made, and that's fine. But I have always loved you. And then he says, there's going to be this time where I will rebuild you. And this is the vision. He says, I'll build you up again. You, virgin Israel, you'll be made new. That's what he's saying. We can hit the reset button. You'll be made new. And again, this is the vision for what we're going to be rebuilt with. That we will take up our timbrels, our tambourines, and we will go out to dance and be joyful. What he's saying is he will rebuild us to dance. That's what he's saying. So the question is for us, who here loves to dance? Okay, Kizzy likes to dance. Who knows how to dance? Show of hands. Okay, show of hands. Who doesn't know how to dance? Okay, so I propose that maybe that's the wrong question, because we're born to dance. Any parent, everyone comes out dancing. You unlearn dancing. You develop self-consciousness, and then you forget how to dance. So I think the more appropriate question is who remembers how to dance, and then who's forgotten. So I remember how to dance, but my memories are super awkward. So my memories of dancing, I have memory, but they're super awkward and really stiff. But my boys, growing up with a super awkward and stiff dancing father, I never taught them how to dance. But as kids, they dance. You want to see a video of Noah, a young Noah dancing? Should we watch that? As his father, I was trying to edit it shorter, and I couldn't cut anything out. There was just nothing that I could cut. I could watch that again and again and again. So what do we take away from this? Should we go dance more? That's not a bad takeaway. I think this world actually wouldn't be bad if we danced more. I have a plan. I don't know if I'm capable of executing this plan. So next year during Holy Week, I would like to have Maundy Thursday. We'll have a beautiful meal together. We'll celebrate Jesus' meal and his washing of the feet. We'll do that. Good Friday, we'll spend some time just immersed in things that we need to change in our lives, some bad habits that are hurting ourselves, each other. And then Saturday night, I would like to have a vigil, which the church has practiced for years. And I want to come together and have a vigil that ends with a dance party. I think that'd be pretty good. Kizzy's going to be there? Yeah, right? So I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I think that's not a bad takeaway. But maybe another takeaway is like this, that maybe our job in this world is to be reminded, like he says, that we're loved with an everlasting love, that we remind us and the people around us that we're loved to the point of where God wants us to dance. And that our work as the church isn't this heavy moral obligation. It's to delight in each other as God delights in us so that we can dance. Gregory Boyle, who's a Franciscan priest, he says it like this. Our frightened selves want only for the gathered to like us, to agree with us, or to be intimidated by us. I suppose Jesus walks into a room and loves what he finds there. He delights in it. In fact, maybe he makes a beeline to the outcasts and chooses in them to go where love has not yet arrived. His ways aren't our ways, but they sure could be. We have grown accustomed to thinking that loving as God does is hard. We think it's a moral strain and obligation. We presume it requires a spiritual muscularity of which we are not capable, a layering of burden on top of sacrifice with a side order of guilt. And he says, maybe it's about delight. Thomas Merton says it like this: no despair of ours can alter the reality of things or the stain of the joy of the cosmic dance, which is always there. We are invited to forget ourselves on purpose, cast our awful solemnity into the winds, and join in the general dance. Jesus says, I pray that my joy will be in you and that my joy may be complete in you. And Dorothy Day calls this the duty to delight. That's our task. It's a duty that we find stranger, neighbor, enemy, family, and we try to see them as God sees them and delights in them. So maybe for some of us, I have a chart. I don't know what it looks like. You know, maybe in the middle, there's friends and family. And I think that could switch depending on what our family situation, what our friend situation is. So I think when we talk about delight, it can be easier with friends because we've chosen them. Sometimes it can be easy with family. Sometimes it could be the hardest. Then maybe probably the easiest are acquaintances. Like people we don't have any like moral, like emotional investment in. And so, yeah, I could probably delight in them. And then there's probably like a larger category of just nebulous strangers. Just like, yeah, you know, I could probably go to the whoever's serving the table and try to find something. Like that's doable. And then maybe on the outside is the ring of those who have intentionally hurt us, like purposefully. We've got their names. And so our call to forgive again and again, to love our enemies, isn't just, oh, yeah. To try to see them as a baby dancing and to try to find God's delight in that. And then if you're like me, I propose the hardest one in this is the self. To see God as I see my son. I can see my son like that, but it's hard for me to understand that God sees me like that. And until I can receive that delight, we can't offer delight to the world. And then maybe our job as the church is beautiful and amazing. And maybe we're to cheer what in people that don't seem cheerable. Or don't find themselves, that there's nothing in them that can celebrate. I have an instructional video on how to cheer. And I think this would be an excellent instructional video for the church. And what if we saw our task in this world as not just this heavy moral obligation, but to see the world and to see others and to see the community as God sees us, and then to help us celebrate it to the point of dancing. And then in this text, he's saying, I will return you. I'll make you new again. And one day you're going to grab instrument and tambourine, and then you will dance. And then he finishes, and I'll just finish up with this. This is the last picture. Again, you will plant vineyards. There's a garden on the hills of Samaria. The farmers will plant them and enjoy their fruit. There will be this day when watchmen cry out on the hills of Ephraim, come, let us go up to Zion, to this garden, to the Lord our God. And so commentators and theologians talk about this garden, that this is the main metaphor for us in life. And even in the resurrection narrative, and so you've got Jesus' disciples, and they're scared, and they're devastated, and they've been huddling in a room. It's been the most devastating 3 days of their life. They don't know what to do. They thought this guy would save them, rescue them, and then he's dead. And then you've got Mary Magdalene, who kind of has a spotted past, but Jesus found delight in her, gave her dignity. And so she's the one, she can't sleep, and she kind of wanders down to the tomb. And the tomb just looks off, like a little bit wrong. And she gets closer and closer, and then the stone is rolled away. So she runs back, tells the guys, then Peter and John have a foot race to the tomb because it's always a competition, I guess. And then John makes sure he wins. And then they get there, and then they run back to tell the fellows. And Mary's the only one who's present. She can stay present. And she's standing at the door of the tomb, and she's weeping. And then these two angels come, and they start talking to her. And then in a moment, they're gone, and then Jesus is standing there. And then what does she mistake him for? She thinks he's the what? The gardener. And what theologians say is in the garden, it was really, really good. And God invited us to create with him in the garden. And we were like, I think we can do better our way. And then in Jesus' resurrection as the gardener, he's recreating the garden again. And now we're invited back into it. And so for us, then, on this Easter of redemption of our world and our neighborhoods and our cities, where is our garden? What does it look like? And what do we do in that creative process? So I'm going to close with an example. And I was hesitant to use it because it's kind of a spectacular example and it's kind of sexy. And we set up the expectation that our garden's going to be sexy. And then we set up this expectation that we're going to change the world. I think we should just name it. I think that's more capitalism than it is. We can't all change the world. That's not sustainable, right? I think we should do what Jean Vanier says and Mother Teresa says. We're not called to do extraordinary things. We're called to do small things with extraordinary love. And so we're going to have artist gardens. We're going to have teacher gardens. We're going to have accounting gardens. We're going to have optometry gardens. We're going to have lumber gardens. We're going to have craftsman gardens. And our gardens, most like, if you've ever gardened, it's not that sexy. It's mainly like pulling out weeds and turning, like it's just garden, right? That's probably what it's going to look like. So I was hesitant to tell the story, but I am, because it's beautiful. And maybe it can reignite our imagination for our garden that's probably going to be more simple, but we're called to it in this Easter to participate in redemption. And so there's a guy, he's a Franciscan priest. His name is Gregory Boyle. He landed in the hardest part of LA in the 80s. It was gang-ridden. He didn't have tools for it, but he landed there and he says, well, I've got it. This is my garden. I got to figure this out. So he started doing like gang interventions and signing peace treaties between rival gangs. And he said it didn't work. They would just stop and then they would go back to shooting. And he found that he was fueling fire on the violence. So he tried giving them hope and helping them find jobs. And it wasn't working that well. One day he sat with a Hollywood investor who was wanting to contribute. The guy wanted to do like give to something specific. They were sitting at his church. Across the street, there was an abandoned bakery. So just on a whim, Gregory Boyle says, why don't you buy that bakery and we'll give jobs to these young men and women. So 20 years later, They have a $14 million budget. They employ 400 people. They have Homeboy Bakery. They have Homegirl Cafe. I think there's a cafe in LAX. They have counseling services for them. They had to start doing tattoo removals because one of the guys really wanted a job, but his forehead said, F the world. And he's like, I don't know why I can't find a job. Like, so they worked on that. And then he tells this story of Lewis. And Lewis was one of their first employees. At one point, the bakery burned down, and he remembers him standing in the rubble just weeping. They got new investors. They built a newer, bigger bakery. And then Lewis's job was to give people tours when they came through. So one day, he goes to Father Gregory Boyle. They call him G. And this is what he wrote. He says, damn, G. He shakes his head. What's up with white people anyways? Gregory Boyle's white. He goes, I was actually curious as to what is up with us. So I said, I don't know. What is up with us? He goes, I mean, damn, they always be using the word great. And he goes, we do? He's like, hell yeah. A bunch of gabachos came in here and they stormed in. They said this place is firm and clean and the machines are working proper. And they say, this place is great. And then they see us homies and enemies working together all the time. They say, you fellas are great. They taste our bread and go, this bread is great. And he goes, I mean, damn, G, why do white people always be using the word great? And then Gregory Ball says, I tell him I don't know. But trust me, every opportunity I find after that to tell him how great he is, I do it just to mess with him. 4 months later, it's nearly closing time. I arrive at the bakery in the evening. Lewis sees me in the parking lot from inside the building and rushes outside. He's excited, yet enthusiasm is never a card that Lewis leads with. He's too cool for that. He barely lets me get out of my car and he says, hey, G, thrilled to see me. You're not going to believe what happened to me yesterday after my shift. He proceeds to tell me that after work, he goes to pick up his 4-year-old daughter, Tiffany, at the babysitter's. He puts her in the car. They drive to their tiny apartment, where for the first time, Lewis is paying rent with honestly earned clean money. He unlocks the front door. Tiffany scurries in down the hallway and lands in their modest home. She plants her feet in the living room and extends her arm and takes in the whole room with her eyes, and she declares with an untethered smile, this is great. He turns to me and says, I thought she was turning white on me. He tells me that he lowers himself to her eye level, placing his hands on his knees for support. And he looks at her and says, what's great, Tiffany? Tiffany clutches her heart and gushes, my home. And Lewis seems unable to speak at exactly this moment. Our eyes find each other and our souls well up along with our eyes. We can't stop staring at each other and tears make their way south on our faces. In what seems like longer than I'm sure it was, I break the silence and I pointed at him and I said, you did this. You never had a home in your life. Now you have one. You did this. You were the biggest drug dealer in town. Now you stopped and you're baking bread instead. You did this. You've never had a father in your life and now you are one. And I hate to tell you this, but you're great. And then he says this. Unfortunately, the first time I retrieved the story from my memory was to tell it at Lewis's funeral. He wasn't doing anything wrong on a Wednesday afternoon. He was killed. He was loading the trunk of his car in the projects, readying himself for a camping trip with friends. Two gang members with their faces covered entered enemy territory looking for fools slipping. They saw Lewis and must have thought to themselves, he'll do. They walked up to him and executed him. I told this great story at Lewis's funeral, largely because of the questions that had been repeatedly asked by his friends and homies during the week that spanned his death and burial. What's the point, they asked, of doing good if this can happen to you? And I said it was a good question, worthy of a response. And I told that packed church that Lewis was a human being who came to know the truth about himself and liked what he found there. Julian of Norwich, a 14th century English mystic, saw the life struggle as coming to discover that we are clothed in God's delight and goodness. This became Lewis's life work. He embraced his goodness, God's delight, his greatness, and nothing was the same again. And he says, and really, what is death compared to knowing that? And my prayer is that on this Easter, as we remember and we celebrate resurrection and redemption, that we'll hear God returning us to ourselves. We'll do the work of returning us to each other, and we'll start the garden again, invite others to it. So let me pray for us. And so God, in our world of fractured families, in a world of killing fields and of the walking dead, Christ, you are the head of the resurrection parade, transforming our tears of betrayal into tears of delight, giving us dancing shoes for the resurrection party. And you are the glittering God who has danced in the dragon's jaws of death, who now dances a dance that is full of nothing than the fullness of God. And now you invite us into this dance of new creation, this dance of life out of death. And in this dance that was broken and strangled and alienated and dislocated and disconnected is now reconciled. And you invite us home to be healed and made whole. And we thank you for this. And may you give us the grace to dance in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.